recent addition to Chapman University's faculty with the Institute for Quantum Studies there. And I wanted to briefly give you a story about some recent, very rapidly developing technology in superconducting circuits on the great path toward building a quantum computer in a practical sense, and point out a lot of the really interesting things that are happening with these circuits already that sort of get at the heart of what Yekir has been talking about for decades and decades. We still see these ideas pop up in a very practical sense in the laboratory. Before I continue, I'll mention Chapman's a very nice place. It has nice weather. You should come visit in the winter because there's no snow there. This is my current group. Luis Pedro Garcia Pintos is in the room here. He's helping me out figure out all this stuff. And Shiva Barcili is a graduate student. So feel free to come visit. We will enjoy you. There's a quick outline here. I'll give you a very brief, mostly pictorial overview of the current state of superconducting technology and what that means, and then talk about some very interesting things that you can do with it, in particular the weak continuous monitoring of a qubit undergoing evolution with a Rabi drive, and some various filtering, time symmetric stuff, weak value stuff, jump dynamics that happen when you monitor such a thing. And I'll talk about how to implement partial projections in a completely different way using quantum circuits and show that this has been done, it works well, and that allows a different route toward accessing all of these weak value experiments, weak measurement experiments in a different way. And I'll close with a recent experiment that was done related to Leggett-Gargan inequalities using just such weak measurements in a working superconducting circuit. So, for those who are unfamiliar with superconducting technology, this is the current workhorse of most superconducting circuits. It's a 3D, or it's a transmon. This particular thing is a 3D transmon because it sits in a 3D cavity. But what a transmon is a nonlinear oscillator where the inductance of my oscillation is given by a Josephson junction. And that nonlinear inductance then causes the potential well of this thing to look like a cosine. And so it's anharmonic toward the bottom. And we can pick out the bottom two energy levels of this cosine potential and declare that to be a qubit. But importantly, these are fairly macroscopic objects, superconducting, cooled down to millikelvin temperatures. And you're talking about macroscopic charge oscillations. So these are different energy levels of macroscopic charge oscillations. And the amazing thing is you can still get coherent superpositions of these that you can then use. There are also variations on this transmon idea that are now confined to 2D planar technology. And this is sort of taking off as a more scalable variety that we can build into an actual computer. So in this case, you replace sort of the LC circuit with physical capacitors and a 2D wafer. And again, the Josephson junctions provide your nonlinearity, but they, and this is from the Martinez group, who's also partnered with Google now. They use double Josephson junctions, so they could use a magnetic field to control the tuning of this thing. That allows them to drive the qubit, do gates, all sorts of stuff. And they couple to other planar things, like a planar waveguide. Here's another bus that connects to something else. They have control lines that can generate the magnetic field to tune the resonance energy, et cetera. So it's all fully controllable electronically, which is a good step forward to actually scaling it up into something useful. Now, there's a lot in this slide, so I'll walk you through it. This is the current paradigm of how measurements are done at all in such a circuit. And what's interesting about this is that we have a fundamental problem. We put our transmon on a chip, we put it in a refrigerator, we cool it down to millikelvin temperatures, and now we want to measure it. How do we do it? I can't just go open my fridge and look at what is the energy state of this thing. I have to find some actual mechanism to do a measurement. So the way it's done is that you send via a coax cable a microwave signal into the cavity. It interacts with the qubit. It escapes the cavity, goes outside your fridge, and then you can look at the signal. Then you've got information about your qubit. So if we look at how this works, you take a microwave signal coming in. It enters a cavity that's interacting with your qubit. And then it escapes. You mix it with a pump, you amplify it, and then you read out that signal, and that gives you a noisy current that's now time continuous, and that gives you your information about the qubit. Now, what I like thinking about this is if you think about this input line as sort of a ticker tape, you can think of it as cut up into small delta t's of different coherent states. And if you're working in the regime where this cavity is a lossy cavity, so this bad cavity regime, then as you pull this ticker tape through your cavity, you're just going to get the steady state behavior for every delta t. And you can ignore any of the transient effects. So what you get in that case is this ticker tape coming in. Each slice delta t interacts with the qubit, reaches a steady state with that qubit, leaves the cavity, and now I have that information encoded in my transmission line as the escaped field. I can then let that propagate down this transmission line, and then eventually I will measure it. Now, Lev should like this because it enables a very interesting thing, that I can choose much after the field has interacted with my qubit how this measurement is going to affect the qubit. It's a delayed choice experiment. And the reason this is so is that the field that comes out here, if this is the input in the phase space picture, when it interacts with the qubit, it splits the field into two overlapping lobes in the phase space. These are now entangled with the qubit. And so I have this traveling entanglement with the qubit going down my transmission line. Now what I do with this parametric amplifier is I choose an angle and squeeze the phase space. And depending on how I squeeze the phase space, I'm either going to get one of two different kinds of dynamics. If I squeeze it this way, then you see that I'm separating the two lobes corresponding to the two qubit states, and I can read that out and learn information about my qubit state. However, if I squeeze it the other way, then I'm suppressing that information, and when I measure my field along the other axis, I'm going to only learn information about the photon number in my cavity. Nothing about my qubit state. And so retroactively, what that's going to do is at the point that I measure my field, it'll collapse that entire transmission line, and through the entanglement with the qubit, it'll drive the qubit with completely different types of physical evolution. So even in this extremely standard way that things are being measured, there's still something interesting there. And in the many worlds approach, this would be not surprising at all. But if you like to think about collapse or something where there's not things propagating that are not definite, it's a little bit surprising. It has all the flavor of a delayed choice experiment. That being said, I'm going to consider this case where we want to learn something about the qubit itself. And I'm going to consider this case where these lobes are very much overlapping. And so you get a noisy signal where you really can't tell per unit time what's going on with the qubit. This is the weak measurement case. And you see these two overlapping Gaussians then resemble very much the weak measurement paradigm of Ecure, who has just walked in. So this is now a time-continuous way of sampling a single quantum system using a succession of weak measurements. And what that does is it produces what's called a quantum trajectory about the evolution of that quantum system as I learn little bits of information time step toward. Good. Now, this is what a current chip in the Martinez group with Google looks like. Each one of these things is a separate qubit. There are 9 of them on this chip. Each qubit has its own measurement resonator that's attached to it, where it's read exactly as I just described. All those measurement resonators are attached to a filter, which suppresses the Purcell effect so that the excitations of the qubit don't fly outside everything. And each qubit has an individual control line that allows you to completely manipulate its state other than measurement. So this is starting to look like a real processor. You can actually do interesting quantum experiments on this. Okay, so that's your lightning overview of what we're talking about. This is how it actually works. Now let's see what interesting things you can do with it. So this is actual experimental data from the UC Berkeley team of Irfan Siddiqui, where they did such a thing with a single 3D transmon, and they can monitor the state collapse. And Andrew provided a very nice overview of this for this case in his talk previously. And so what you can do is see that for a particular run of the experiment, then you can actually watch the qubit progressively collapse to one of its eigenstates. That's already pretty neat. And if you average over an ensemble of those types of things, then you'll recover the usual ensemble evolution, which takes you straight to a mixed state, because you don't know which way it collapsed on average. But now you can do something more interesting, which is starting to turn on a Robbie drive and watch this qubit rotate around in time. And you can actually see that rotation by reading out that continuous measurement record. So here you see sort of a slow rotation, and we can crank up the Robbie drive and see much more pronounced rotations. And again, if we average over a big ensemble of these things, then we'll recover that smooth ensemble average Lindblad dynamics, where everything becomes a mixed state in the end. But the important thing is, for these individual trajectories, I'm talking about one qubit that's sitting on my chip. There is no ensemble here, and I'm looking in time what that qubit's doing. So it's a very different paradigm than we usually think of in quantum, where I always implicitly talk about many, many, many preparations and then seeing statistics. Here I'm talking about a single run. And to drive that point home, this is what you actually see on your oscilloscope in a single run. So the question is, how do you get from that to any meaningful information about the thing you're trying to monitor? Now, what's very interesting to me is that there's a few approaches. Suppose I'm a skeptic who has never heard of quantum mechanics and said, I got this thing. And someone claims that this tells me something about something that's actually evolving. And I say, yeah, right. What am I going to do? I'm going to take this and I'm going to filter it, just with classical filtering theory. Just take this noisy signal and try to filter it. And so if I take, in this case, just a simple causal single pole filter, which is just an exponential smoothing map that goes forward in time. You can implement this with just resistors, capacitors, et cetera, on some circuit. Then I can smooth out most of this noise and recover something like these orange lines here. And you can kind of see that, yeah, there's kind of something going on there, but it's not totally clear. The noise effectively hides the true evolution of what's going on, and that's a key quantum feature. But using quantum state trajectory formalism, we can add additional prior information and say, A, I know this is a qubit, and B, I know how it's supposed to be evolving. And if I know those two things, then I can take the same filter and just filter this data, and you'll recover the true state evolution corresponding to the qubit, which is this black line that's hidden behind it. But there's a caveat. You only recover your best estimate of that state evolution based on your assumptions that went into this model. But we can go further. Suppose I am a skeptic, I still don't believe in quantum theory, and say, OK, let me just filter this signal going forward in time, now that I have this fixed record that I've measured. I'm going to filter it going backward in time, just the exponential smoothing of the raw readout. And then I'm going to combine these two, just average them together, and say, well, I know that such fixed delay smoothing classically is going to give me the best estimate of this noisy thing that I'm trying to find. If I do that, you get this orange line instead. And if you compare this orange line to the quantum filter that reconstructs the actual qubit evolution, you see it's pretty good. It's not perfect, but it's remarkably good. And that can convince a skeptic that even though I say I'm doing something quantum, say there's something going on, just doing a simple filtering thing, I can actually track, at least qualitatively, what the dynamics are of that state. Which now, again, I'm talking about the x-coordinate of a qubit, single qubit, that's evolving in time. And I would normally think of this thing as an ensemble average of the Pauli X operator, but here I'm watching it with my classical readout move up and down in time. And this is a model-independent way to do this. Now, another interesting feature about this is once I add my extra quantum trajectory information, I say this is really a qubit, I filter my readout, I see an erasure of my knowledge of the boundary conditions. What I mean by that is that since I'm guessing how this is actually evolving, I don't really know, I just see this noisy thing, I know how it should evolve, I can say, well, let me start it at two possible different initial states. There's this sort of light line here or this dark line here, and just say, oh, let me filter the same signal given these two prior assumptions about what possible qubit state it was. And what you find is that that information is erased over the time scale of the measurement, and eventually, no matter which initial state I picked, that synchronizes. And so in some sense, the subjectivity of my initial guess is removed. I can now say at this point that following this seems objective. It didn't depend on any of my subjectivity. But now I can do the same thing in reverse and say, okay, well, let's look at the end of my record. I can filter it going backwards as well. And this is not the reversing that Andrew was talking about. I'm not unwinding the evolution. I'm evolving what's called a retrodictive state, going backward in time. And this is exactly equivalent to Yakir's two-state formalism, where there's a second state that can go backward. But now I can evolve it backward, knowing that noise and that fixed interval. And I'll see that, again, any subjectivity about a post-selection, a possible post-selection, gets erased as I go backward in time. And eventually, it becomes objective. And this is very interesting, because that means that other than some caps on the end of my fixed evolution, everything in between is completely determined by the readout. I may not know anything about pre and post selection, but if I know that readout, then I have a pretty good idea of what both the forward propagating state is doing and what the backward propagating state is doing. Readout determines the evolution in some fundamental way here. Now, that leads to an interesting possibility. I have both a forward evolving state for my entire interval, which has no subjective content that I inserted. I also have a backward evolving state for the entire interval, which again has no subjective content that I inserted. So I have two different states, and they don't agree with each other. So immediately you can say, well, which is the correct state? Most people would say the forward one is the correct state, of course. But an interesting possibility is to say, well, in some sense, both are the correct state. You need both of them. This is the essence of the two-time formalism. So if I think that and say, let's look at both the forward and backward, then I know that the weak value of an observable given forward and backward states is the best estimate of what that observable's value was in between. You can prove this rigorously using the Ozawa RMS error definition. So that's an interesting connection. So if I just take that at face value and say, well, if I look at the weak value of each of my state coordinates, x, y, and z, given these initial states, what do I get? Well, you look at this, you see two different states here, and you smooth it in this time symmetric way, and you get this. Now, what's very interesting about this is that this coordinate you're monitoring, in this case x, the noise magically disappears. It becomes extremely smooth evolution. The other coordinate stays relatively noisy, and I'll explain that in a minute. But it seems to do what I thought it would do, which is smooth out the noise, give me the best estimate that minimizes my error, and say, based on this one readout that I got collected, this is my best objective estimate of what my state was doing in between. Fine. Now, all this works in a regime where I'm measuring more strongly as well. So if I measure more strongly, then I fundamentally change the dynamics. I'm going to start xenopinning my qubit so that it wants to be in one of its eigenstates. So that's what you're seeing here. And this is, again, just RC filtering the signal one way, RC filtering the signal the back way. Combine my two classical filters, and I can follow the jump dynamics pretty well. And again, the noise is much reduced when I use this time symmetric smoothing picture, even classically. But now, if I look at the quantum picture of this, it gets much more interesting. But I do the same trick where I have forward and backward evolution that's completely determined by one single record, one single measurement record. And I combine them and say, what's the best estimate of my state in between? And we see this instead. So again, the monitored coordinate now has very smooth evolution. Almost all the noise is gone. And it's tracking the jumps, which are, in fact, the same jump structure that I saw with the classical averaging. So in some sense, I believe that this really does correspond to what's physically going on. But now the other coordinate, this sigma z in this case, goes wildly outside of its eigenvalue bounds. This is part of the weak value paradigm. What could that possibly mean? That seems like nonsense. Well, what's interesting is because this is in the Heisenberg picture, if I add a Rabi drive with sigma y, then I get these flips in the xz plane. If I compute what x dot is in the Heisenberg picture, I'll get omega times z. So z has the meaning of the velocity of x in the Heisenberg picture. And if I look at what is this thing that I said z is in this time symmetric way, and I compare it to what is actually the derivative of this blue curve, just numerically, they perfectly agree. So even though I say that if I want to interpret sigma z as opposed to having eigenvalues plus and minus 1. That seems inconsistent. But if I reinterpret it as this is representing the true velocity of what I'm monitoring, then I get exactly what I expect to see. OK, enough about continuous readouts for now. I'll briefly discuss how to do partial projections in these circuits if you don't want to think about continuous monitoring. So what's a partial projection? A partial projection is a generalized measurement, which can be a projection, a weak measurement, anything in between, and it can even be unbalanced. So you get more of a projection one way than the other way. The general operators that do this are these D0 and D1, and they're completely characterized by two probability parameters, P and Q. And what's nice is that any measurement you want to do on a qubit is a combination of rotations and this partial projection formalism. You can always decompose it this way. So if we have a way to do this in a circuit sense, we can always do any strength of measurement we want in any quantum circuit. Here's such a circuit. So you take some system you want to measure. You take an ancilla qubit, rotate it, do a control Z operation, rotate it, and measure your ancilla. And the net effect on your original qubit will be exactly of this partial projecting type. And pictorially, it looks like this. You take your initial ancilla, rotate it, do control Z, which flips the state around this axis, and then you rotate it back up, and then you measure the vertical axis. And what you see is that there's some finite distinguishability of your two states now. And as you take that angle smaller and smaller, your distinguishability goes down. That's equivalent to a weak measurement. OK, so this is how the Martinez group did this. They took two qubits in their planar technology. Used one as an ancilla, used the other as a data qubit that they're going to use, which I'll explain briefly later, did exactly this protocol, which in their language looks like this sequence of microwave pulses. Prepare your data qubit, then you rotate your ancilla, do a control Z operation with a DC pulse, rotate your ancilla, and then do a measurement. And now you've partially projected your data qubit. And you can see the contrast of the readout here as a function of that angle, which shows that you can go all the way from a projective measurement, where they're perfectly correlated, to a weak measurement, where there essentially is no information per shot. And this is how you calibrate such a thing. Essentially, you just take this contrast curve and you invert it so that you get 1 and minus 1. And we compared several different ways of calibrating it. All of them agree. And then we used such partial projections in a 4-qubit circuit to do a hybrid Bell-Leggett-Garg test, just to show that this actually works. Without belaboring the details, the idea is that in a Bell test, you normally have 4 different experiments you need to do, or you're sampling different ensembles. But if you can sample a single ensemble and do all 4 of your Bell measurements on that one ensemble, then you have something interesting. But you'll only see something interesting if 2 of the measurements you do are weak. I think this idea is a variation of one done by Markovitch and Resnick some years ago. This is sort of the quantum computing implementation of such a thing. Here's the actual circuit. I'll skip that. Here's the implementation of this circuit as a sequence of microwave pulses that they actually used. Here are the individual correlators in this Bell-like inequality. So there's the 4 correlators compared with their theory curves. These are plus and minus 10 sigma error bars, so it worked pretty well. And you combine all of those correlation terms together from a single measurements setting ensemble. And in fact, you see what you expect to see, which is as the measurement strength of your first 2 measurements gets weaker and weaker and weaker, you preserve your original Bell state, and you can recover exactly the violation of the Bell inequality you expect to see, because there's been no state disturbance in between. So with that, I'll close and give you the big punchline, which is superconducting processors, in fact, work. And there's exciting amounts of progress happening. It's extremely rapid. It's hard to keep up with what they're doing. But we're seeing very interesting quantum features appearing already, including continuous weak measurements and discrete weak measurements, tunable strength. It's all there. It all works. And this time symmetric stuff actually has practical advantages. It's not just a thought experiment. It actually gives you better results in a practical way for interpreting all these noisy signals. So with that, I will say thank you.
I love this. This is great stuff.
Thank you.
What do you think you learned from the experiments that you have been describing that you would not learn from a student running a suitably designed quantum algorithm successfully on John Martini's processor or one like it? And conversely, are there things that you would learn from being able to do bigger and bigger calculations involving larger and larger number of qubits that would, from which you might learn something completely fresh that would not come out of running things on a very few qubit processor?
That's a very good pair of questions. The short answer is that the more interesting quantum effects will keep appearing as you grow your Hilbert space. And so as you add more and more qubits, you'd expect to see something more intrinsically quantum appear, some entanglement effects, that sort of stuff. Contextuality features will become more manifest. On these few qubit systems, you see hints of that, but it takes some ingenuity to come up with interesting experiments that highlight them. But I expect to see those becoming more and more intrinsic to anything you do for larger and larger algorithms. As far as your other question, I think there's a nice mapping between everything that Yakir and everyone has talked about for years into these just digital circuits. You don't really lose much once you start mapping it over into these circuits. So most of these thought experiments can now just be translated into an algorithm and run. And then you can really test it out and see what happens.
Well, you might think, for example, that a larger calculation is not just a giant size wave function evolving, because of the interventions that you have, for example, for fault-tolerant error correction.
That's true, though the premise of the error correction codes is that they leave subspaces invariant. So you hope that you're not actually perturbing those subspaces. You preserve the quantum features you want to leave there. But you're right, if that's not actually true, then you're going to screw everything up, so to speak.
I have two questions. First, I want you to clarify, when you talk about continuous measurement, you say it's best estimate of observable value. Value of observable value, what exactly you meant by this?
Yeah, so.
And it's just as a second question, that you run this forward and backward and you get a different result. If it's happened to be that your post-selection forward evolving state which come to this state. Will the backward evolving picture be identical to the forward evolving one?
So the second question I think is yes. And if you arrange it so it's perfect, then they will be identical. Up to this time reversibility of the continuous readout, so that may cause some problems. But in the unitary case, definitely. And the other question is, what do I mean by best estimate? If you want to think about weak values not as ontic things, but as statistical things, then you can prove that if I want to know, for example, the average value of x, given that I know information prior and posterior to x, then the best estimate of that average value is in fact equal to the real part of a weak value. So I don't need to make any other claims. I can just show this mathematically that is in fact the best estimate. Then I can use that. And I, in fact, recover what I expected to see classically from just classical smoothing.
If you get it anomalous, or what do you mean by it?
Yeah, if you get it anomalous, then that's the question, is what does this mean? But this is a great example here. It is anomalous, but there is some deep physical meaning behind that anomaly. It's a derivative. It's a velocity.
Holger.
Yeah, I was wondering, I really liked how you pulled the signal out of all the noise by filtering. I was just wondering, is it just a normal spectral filtering that is possible because of the Rabi oscillation or some other trick, and can that be generalized to complicated correlations?
Yeah, so this is a good question. So classical filtering theory is a vast, vast subject, and you can apply Wiener filters, Kalman filters, all that kind of stuff to this, and you'd get a better result than I showed. Mm-hmm. But my point here was that even with the simplest possible approach, approach, just a single pole filter exponentially going forward, mm-hmm. combined with a single pole filter exponentially going backward, you still get remarkably good results. So of course you can get better than that if you're more sophisticated.
Yeah, and could it be generalized to more complicated systems, like when you don't just have a Rabi oscillation, but some more complicated quantum dynamics?
Yes.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this case, we're just driving Rabi oscillations because it's easy.
Yeah,
you can get a long, non-trivial trajectory.
I guess the question is, as you've been talking about a skeptic would not be able to put in assumptions about the dynamics of the system so easily. So you'd have to basically discover the correlations.
In this case, the exponential filtering did not assume any dynamics, which is nice.
That's
exactly what's nice about it.
Yeah.
With the quantum trajectory filtering, you do have to know the dynamics. And in fact, you have to know the dynamics, you have to know the initial state, and you have to know all the efficiencies of the readout, et cetera.
But then the question would be how long such a simple filter would be robust under more and more complex dynamics. Right?
Yeah, yeah. That opens a very interesting research can of worms, I think.
Sorry, guys, we're running out of time. Let's give Justin a minute.